While Governor Andrew Cuomo's political critics on both sides of the aisle may be licking their lips over the nursing home scandal that has embroiled the administration to the point where federal law enforcement officials are probing decisions made during the pandemic, the current political damage to the three-term Democratic governor isn't fatal, according to a recent op-ed in the New York Daily News by Bradley Tusk, a political strategist who is supportive of Cuomo. And Bradley joins us now to discuss the piece. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Bradley, you acknowledge that the fallout from the governor's handling of nursing homes during the pandemic is, quote, certainly ugly, but you're skeptical that he's politically vulnerable heading into a bid for a fourth term next year. Can you explain your line of thought?
Yeah, sure. Look, unless it turns out that there was criminal behavior and the indictments come out of that, I think there's three reasons why, if you had to bet, you would still bet on Cuomo getting elected to a fourth term. The first is, this is a hot issue right now, but when some of the controversy and some of the fighting in Albany subsides, and then more important, when we get to herd immunity, whether that's in June or September, all of a sudden this is going to cease to be, you know, the predominant issue of the day. The primary is still not for another like 8 months after that, and the general election for more than a year after that. So one is just he's got time is on his side. He's got a lot of time. Two is, there are great people to run against him in a primary. In the last two races he's had, he's run against Zephyr Teachout and Cynthia Nixon, who are both very similar candidates and extremely far left, beloved on Twitter, beloved by a handful of reporters, get a lot of attention, and then lose by a 2-1 margin. If someone like that runs against him again, you're going to have the same outcome. And while there may be candidates who are a little more mainstream, especially people of color like Tish James or Eric Adams, who could challenge him statewide, it's a pretty tough thing to do, take on a sitting governor. I would bet that they won't do that. And then the third is the Republican Party in New York just really isn't in a position right now to win a statewide election. We haven't had a statewide elected, I think, since Pataki, and as a Republican. And it's just the party does not have a deep bench. It doesn't have infrastructure, doesn't have resources. So it's a heavy lift.
That framework you laid out was built on an initial caveat about the potential outcome of this federal probe, which we don't know where it's going. It's really in the early stages right now. And what we've heard from reporting is that there's no criminal bent to it. At least this point, it's more of a fact-finding mission. I'm curious, though, what sort of results from this federal inquiry could damage the governor moving forward? And what do you think he might be able to skate from, say, you know, if someone in his circle was found to be doing something criminal, is that something that he could weather?
Yeah, he probably could. But, you know, I think what we've seen in the last few years is the Supreme Court in the McDonald decision raised the standard needed to indict public officials for corruption. So it's not so easy to do. So if you look at Bill de Blasio in New York City, there were multiple local and federal criminal investigations into his behavior. And eventually both the DA and the U.S. attorney came together and said, while there's a lot of smoke, we don't have enough evidence to bring charges. And I suspect that you'll see the same outcome here. The only thing to me that seems like a really material risk is if they lied on federal forms at the federal regulators. I am just assuming that they were smart enough to not do that.
What does it say to you about our political structure in New York or how political power is wielded in the state, or just really the extremely partisan nature of politics right now, that the governor can be under siege the way he is right now? And, you know, as far as you're concerned and how you see it, he can basically just shrug it off.
Yeah, I mean, I think it says that we don't have overall a particularly robust two-party system in New York for sure. I mean, the fact that we're dismissing his chances of losing a general election is simply because the Republican Party in New York is close to defunct. And then I think it's also because, look, we have very, very lax rules around fundraising. So the governor can raise, any governor, vast amounts of money, especially from people who in some way might be doing business with the state. Governor has, you know, the power of the bully pulpit, so really the ability to be out there every single day. And look, where Andrew Cuomo typically shines the most is in a crisis, right? He is great in a natural disaster. And up until the nursing home scandal, he's basically been the hero of COVID, right? So he has had this incredible platform to talk to New Yorkers and reassure them and show some leadership. And people have responded to it. You know, all the polling that I see, including one I just got back this morning, you know, has his approval ratings consistently in the 70s.
You mentioned some of the candidates on the left who might be more serious challengers to the governor in a primary. And in your piece, I believe you mentioned State Attorney General Letitia James, Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams. One of the names I think you didn't mention was the New York City public advocate, Jumaane Williams, who made Kathy Hochul, the lieutenant governor, sweat a little bit in her 2018 primary, but did lose. What do you think of that name? Is that a serious potential challenger?
Yeah, no, I know. And he certainly, you know, I think he tweeted to be upset that I didn't include him in the piece. And it wasn't really an omission by accident. It's that, you know, I do think a candidate of color would be best suited to take on Cuomo, but I think it needs to be a mainstream politician. And Jumaane is very, very progressive. His politics aren't any different or more center than Cynthia Nixon or Zephyr Teachout. So while there's probably some demographic benefit that comes from also being African-American, you know, he did lose the race to lieutenant governor. And while he did win the special election public advocate, I think ultimately he collected less than 1% of the city's population in terms of total votes. So an election that nobody bothered to vote in at all. So, look, he's the strongest of the people who seem to want to do it. But if I were betting money, I would bet on Cuomo to beat Jumaane.
Do you think his 2018 performance represents a ceiling or a floor?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that people don't necessarily take the role of lieutenant governor particularly seriously and don't necessarily look at it the same way they look at governor, right? So if you said, hey, I'm going to vote for Cuomo for re-election because I don't think Cynthia Nixon is qualified to be governor, but he frustrates me, then you might vote against this lieutenant governor as kind of a sign of frustration. When all of a sudden this is the person running the entire state, I don't know if the same calculus applies. So I think it's hard to look at it as a ceiling or a floor.
We're talking about the recent political wounds suffered by the governor over the handling of the pandemic, specifically with regards to nursing homes. And our guest is Bradley Tusk, a political consultant and supporter of Cuomo, who thinks the three-term Democrat is still in good shape to win a fourth term next year. So I'm curious, did anyone ask you to write this piece?
No, no. And by the way, I'm not all that supportive of Cuomo. I have voted for him personally because I find that he's been a generally effective governor. But, you know, I think like anyone who operates in New York politics, I've been on the receiving end of getting yelled at by the governor. And there are plenty of things about his administration that I don't particularly like. The tone. I mean, I think that, look, what Romkin said was not particularly surprising to anyone in New York politics. And I think a lot of people, almost anyone who's worked at a high level in New York politics, has been on the receiving end of threats from, you know, the governor or his team. And by the way, that's how a lot of political operations work all over the country and have, you know, since the beginning of democracy. So it's not that surprising. But, you know, they don't necessarily endear themselves to people as a result. But I think that the argument they make in their campaigns and in general is you may not love us, but we get the job done. And that's generally been true in my experience, and I think New Yorkers clearly get that, and that's why he keeps getting reelected. But no, you know, just there were so many whispers about, hey, this is the time that Cuomo is going to finally go down, and I think because he's been in power for so long and because he's personally had difficulties with so many different people in the media and high levels of politics, you know, there's this sort of buzz around, oh, maybe this is the time that he finally goes down, and, you know, tons and tons of schadenfreude. And I wrote the column basically to say, look, you know, it can be fun to sort of wish that someone credible runs against him, and it's fun to gossip about all this stuff and speculate. But when you take a step back and just look at the numbers and look at where the race is, if you had to bet right now, he's still likely to get reelected.
Have you heard from anyone in the Cuomo administration or the governor's orbit after writing this piece?
I have one or two people who are kind of affiliated with him said nice piece. But, you know, typically whenever I write something in the place of the Daily News about politics, I get a decent amount of feedback from other people in politics. So nothing really more than that.
Are you surprised by the response from the Democratic legislative leaders in recent days? They've been, you know, reluctant to take a real hard line against the governor, more like just sort of laying out their options they have at this point without actually committing to anything.
No, I mean, I think that ultimately he is the most powerful person in the state of New York, especially when you have a weak mayor like Bill de Blasio. And so you're any individual state senator or state rep, with the exception of maybe the speaker and the majority leader, are fairly powerless compared to the governor. So you have some that are out there banging the drum because that fits their politics really well. But I think most of them still recognize that, look, I want to be able to get my agenda through, my projects funded, the things that I need. And if you go as far as to say the governor should be impeached or that all his power should be stripped, it's going to be pretty hard to then have that kind of relationship with his office. So it's not particularly surprising. The question is, where does it go from here? You now have a call from Ron Kim for impeachment. You have, I think, 11 members who have said we should at least strip away the emergency powers he was given when COVID started. And now we'll see kind of how good Team Cuomo is at damage control, because if they jump into action now and they're able to make amends and to a certain extent show some humility and show maybe some regret, then I think they could probably still manage their way out of this thing. If they turn up the volume, then look, I don't think it knocks Cuomo out of office. But it does mean that, you know, the next few months in Albany will be very interesting.
And what do you make, you know, while the legislative leaders themselves aren't really pushing anything too aggressively right now, Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins seems to be a lot more responsive to the members in her conference that want to see something done to hold the governor accountable, whether it's stripping oversight powers or doing some sort of investigation. Compared to Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, who, you know, seems to have a tighter grip on his conference at this time. Does that sort of dynamic surprise you? And do you also think that's, you know, a representative of what's happening?
I think it is representative of what's happening. Some of it is just the nature of the two different bodies. I think this is true in state legislatures all over the country, which is, you know, there are fewer senators. So as a result, they represent more people and they have more autonomy. Whereas in the assembly, because there are so many members, you know, the vast, vast majority of them don't really have that much individual power, which really centralizes it in the hands of the speaker. We certainly saw that with Shelley Silver for a very, very long time, but we're seeing it with Hastie now, too. And even if you think about the U.S. Congress, you know, any individual senator just has a lot more leeway to do what they want than a House member does. So one is just the nature of the bodies. But two, look, Stewart-Cousins ran a really aggressive campaign last fall to elect more members into her conference. She won. They now have a supermajority. She has sort of, she took the risk. She put in the work. She raised the money. And now she's reaping the benefits.
Well, we've been speaking with political strategist Bradley Tusk. Bradley, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Capitol Press Room, which you can take with you on the go wherever you download podcasts. Our engineer in Syracuse is Dave White. My producer in Albany is Tim Williams. I'm David Lombardo. Thanks for listening.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.